Hi, everybody. I'm Tanzina Vega with you all hour on The Takeaway, and there's not many other places we could start today's show. Tensions between the United States and Iran have continued to escalate over the weekend after the United States' assassination of Iran's top military leader, Major General Qasem Soleimani, who commanded Iran's Revolutionary Guard. In a series of tweets on Saturday, President Trump threatened further military action, particularly against 52 locations in Iran, including cultural sites, if Iran retaliated against the United States. And yet, despite those threats, Ismail Qani, Soleimani's replacement, vowed revenge against the U.S. in response to Soleimani's killing. Iran also announced it would abandon key components of the landmark 2015 nuclear deal almost 2 years after the U.S. withdrew from the deal. Thousands of Iranians have taken to the streets of Tehran to mourn the slain military leader. And Soleimani's killing has also increased U.S. tensions with Iraq, where Parliament voted in support of removing U.S. troops from their country. For more on this, we're joined by Robin Wright, a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and columnist at The New Yorker. Robin, great to have you back on the show.
Great to be with you, Tanzina.
So the airstrike that's killed Soleimani actually took place in Iraq. Let's start there. You spoke with Iraq's President Barham Saleh this weekend. What did he tell you about the fallout in Iraq following the killing of Soleimani?
The Iraqis are deeply concerned because they're still at war with ISIS. There are between 14,000 and 18,000 ISIS fighters still along Iraq's border with Syria. They're concerned about mopping up that operation before and worried about that there will be some kind of new conflict that plays out on its territory between Iran and the United States. Remember, Iraq has been at war now for 40 years, 23 years under Saddam Hussein and 17 years since the U.S. intervention in 2003. And it's feeling very fragile because recent protests have forced the prime minister to resign. He's only in a caretaker position. And the country desperately needs foreign investment and assistance to stabilize so that the young are employed rather than lured into more extremist groups. So there's the stakes in the aftermath of Soleimani's assassination are huge, not just for Iran and the United States, but for the entire Middle East. And Iraq is now at the epicenter of all this and deeply concerned that it will become the battlefield, the theater, the arena of some kind of overt or covert campaign.
What could that mean, Robin, for the fight against ISIS going forward? I mean, we know that the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq and Syria, as you mentioned, Syria, said it would suspend operations against the Islamic State.
It's huge, Tanzina, because the United States had been on the offensive. It had played an incredible role in mobilizing an international coalition. Many other countries are still in Iraq, too, and they also face being expelled because the Iraqi parliament called for the removal of all foreign forces. But in the aftermath of the assassination, the coalition led by the United States and some 5,000 American troops have said they are going to suspend operations and basically become a defensive operation just to protect themselves, not dealing with the aftermath of the ISIS caliphate, not engaging in operations to stabilize the fragile Iraqi government.
We heard Secretary of State Mike Pompeo brush aside the calls of the Iraqi parliament to end the presence of American troops in that country. Does Iraq have any leverage over the United States here?
Well, I think the government is caught kind of between Iran and the United States. Clearly, the United States does not want ISIS to reemerge. In that sense, Iraq has a little bit of leverage, but, you know, President Trump has always talked about pulling all American troops out of the region, and in some ways this accomplishes one of his goals. The problem is that the military challenge remains, and we saw that in the aftermath of the Obama administration's decision to withdraw in 2011 and how that led to the rise or created the open space for the emergence of ISIS, which swept through with lightning speed and seized a third of Syria and a third of Iraq, creating a whole new country, effectively, at least for 4 years, and changing the borders of the modern Middle East. The stakes here are huge.
And over the weekend, as the narrative was emerging about why the president chose to make this move on Soleimani, the Trump administration and the president said Soleimani was planning attacks on American lives. We heard Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on some of the Sunday shows say that it was a series of events, not one particular event, that prompted this. How much intelligence evidence do we have to support what either of these folks is saying?
There's been nothing said publicly, and those who are supposed to be briefed within the House and the Senate have not yet received full briefings. They're hoping to get it this week. The question of what the threat was comes in the aftermath of questions about what justified the U.S. intervention in Iraq in the first place in 2003, when the United States claimed that there were weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. And as we found out, there weren't any. There's a deep concern about the level of intelligence, the specificity. The Iraqis actually said that Soleimani was scheduled to see government officials the next morning on a diplomatic mission. Now, how you define diplomatic would probably differ between the United States, Iraq, and Iran. But I think there are going to be some deep concerns because we do know that there were some in the Pentagon who were flabbergasted, to put it mildly, when the president chose the most radical option among those made available to him, and that was to assassinate Soleimani. A bad guy for sure, but the question is, what was he intending to do, and what is U.S. strategy in the aftermath? Are we just winging it as all of these things play out, or is there an off-ramp, an exit strategy, a game plan, just a basic game plan about what to do?
Well, what we do know is that President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama declined to target Soleimani. And given that the intelligence so far seems thin, at least as far as the public knows, I'm wondering, given domestic and international laws, was this attack legal? Are we considering whether or not the president has once again crossed the line here?
Well, this is a divisive issue in Washington, and I think it's going to play out in the weeks to come. The administration says that the president had the right to take military action to defend American lives and American interests. But it also appears that the kind of legal basis for this is being tied to the original authorization for the use of military force, what's called an AUMF, that was given by Congress in 2001 after the attack on 9/11 that allowed the U.S. to act in Afghanistan. We have used that, extended that mandate to include deployments in Iraq, Syria, and to prolong our physical presence militarily in the region. So there are good questions that will be asked, and I think there are those among Democrats who will probably try to move to limit the authorization to take military action in Iran, partly to avoid an all-out war.
So, Robin, Iran did announce that it would end its commitments to several key aspects of the 2015 nuclear deal. But given that the U.S. pulled out of that same deal in 2018, how significant is that?
It's very important. This story got way out of was exaggerated very quickly. People don't understand enough about how you make a bomb and what was agreed to in the nuclear deal. What happened was, as you rightly pointed out, President Trump withdrew from the deal in 2018 and 6 months later reimposed sanctions. Iran stuck to the deal for a year, as did the five other parties to the deal: Britain, France, China, Russia, and Germany. But as the economic benefits were not felt by Iran, they began slowly to breach its commitments. These are all reversible steps. It began in mid-2019, a year after Trump withdrew, breaching, taking steps that it thought would help pressure the administration into either going back to the original nuclear deal or dealing with Iran on terms that were not kind of one-sided. The latest step is a fifth breach, but Iran is still complying with inspections. So all of the UN, the International Atomic Energy Agency monitors who are in Iran, all the equipment that monitors all their military sites is still in place. It's an ominous development, absolutely, but it's not a fatal development yet.
So to that point, Robin, I'm thank you for the clarification there. And to that point, there are lots of concerns about the 2003 invasion of Iraq and lots of parallels that are being drawn here. I'm curious, you said that this story, particularly about the Iranian relationship with the 2015 nuclear deal, has been overblown. Are you seeing the media sort of handling this in a way that's at least accurate or sensitive or nuanced? Or is it starting to go down certain paths that it shouldn't and that are reminiscent of the way the media covered 2003?
Well, I think particularly on this issue of what did Iran do on the nuclear program, it's easy to overstate it when it said it's no longer going to limit the number of centrifuges. That sends alarm bells off everywhere. But I've talked to arms control experts, people who are involved in, you know, lifelong programs to limit nuclear proliferation. And they say this is a worrisome development, but it is something that can be reversed. There is still, if miracle upon miracles, there's some kind of diplomatic outreach to try to get the two countries back to the negotiating table. This can be reversed. But Iran is clearly not going to be taking any of this lightly, whether it's withdrawal of the nuclear deal, the maximum pressure by the Trump administration, and most recently the Soleimani assassination. We're not talking about the Taliban in Afghanistan, a flaky militia that had a tenuous hold in Afghanistan. We're not talking about Saddam Hussein's Iraq, where the military was inept and willing to turn around and walk away. The Iranian Revolution, whatever you feel about it, has now been in place 40 years. Soleimani was incredibly important to its mission to get the U.S. to withdraw from the region. But Iran has a very deep bench, and it will take several actions, including actions on the nuclear program, action militarily, to retaliate and also to put pressure on the Trump administration, because it has its own broader agenda on diplomacy, too. So this is going to play out for a long time to come on a lot of different levels.
Robin Wright is a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and columnist at The New Yorker. Robin, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
My name is Pupak. I'm calling from Paramus, New Jersey. I just came back from Iran. A large part of my family still lives there. I feel anger and fear. I don't want my beautiful country to become another Syria, Afghanistan, or Iraq. I don't want to lose my family to an unjust war.
The day after Trump was elected, I told friends that he'd create a war in his final year in order to ensure that he was reelected, because we don't change presidents in the middle of a war very often. Rich Minton, Belmont, Mass.
Hi, my name's Beth from Pittsburgh. My husband is an Iranian-born U.S. citizen. We're traveling to Israel in 2 weeks, and now we don't know what to expect when we come back. Will we be allowed back home? We got married last year, and the travel ban prevented much of our family from coming to the wedding. It feels like living in the Twilight Zone.
This is Brandon from Garland. I just feel like almost anything Trump does at this point is a distraction from his impeachment. And the bigger the distraction, the better off his chances are for reelection.
This is The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.